Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast. This is our post-election special where I'm catching up with Gerard Holland, who's the Executive Director of the Page Research Institute, and Migration Watch Director and NatCon Director, Jordan Knight. How are you both guys this morning?
Tired. I'm tired. I don't know, business as usual. I mean, the centre right in Australia suffers a humiliating defeat and it's just another day. So,
Well, are there any silver linings or positives to take out of this?
To be expected, right? Like, I don't think anyone is shocked by the result. Maybe some who are drinking too much of the Kool-Aid. I think the positive here is just like an opportunity to reset. And I'm less, we might get into a little bit later, I'm less great, this means the great acceleration's happening, we're going to have a new reform in 3 years' time, we're going to take back our country. I think our circumstances are uniquely different for a lot of different reasons. So I'm probably pretty pessimistic about the time frame of turning this around. But I think for the first time, really, the right has... is a line in the sand that the direction we're heading in is just not fit for purpose. And actually the kind of post-Reagan libertarian classical liberal consensus, like, that is well and truly shattered and is no longer fit for purpose. And so where do we go from here? And I don't know, I sort of see it like a footy analogy, right? It's like you bail out of the grand final, absolutely crushing defeat, that's something you've been working on for so long, but it's like, well, great, well, now we head back to training on Monday, watch the review tapes, and then see where we go from here. So, it never ends, Dan. It's just this is just a constant cycle. And the fact is, our team just hasn't been on the pitch for the last like 15 years, and that's why we're in this mess. So we've got to get back on it.
Hasn't rethought or adjusted to the times is what I keep telling people. You spent a bit of time in the UK, Gerard, and I'm just struck that the initial analysis by some in the Liberal Party is, they keep harking back to that Theresa May speech saying, oh, we need to rebrand and not be the nasty party, and David Cameron remodeling of the Conservative Party shows the way. And I'm just sort of gobsmacked by that because, A, it's 20-plus years ago and there have been some serious changes in the UK in that time. And my context over there, none of the sensible people in the Tory party think that that's the future. So what do you think?
Oh, so the UK is a really big one, right? A couple of things. Well, okay. I'm trying to think where to start, because there's a couple of different ways into this conversation. If you look at what's happening with reform now, I think it's easy for us on the right to get really, really excited and say this is what we should do. But there is history and context that I think will inform our opinions better. And the Spark Notes version is this. Farage was a Tory MP, right? And he started UKIP back in, I think, 97, 98. So he started UKIP around the same time that Pauline started One Nation. So there's the first step. It's been a 20-year project in order to get to this point in the first place. UKIP was politically irrelevant during most of that time, except for the European Parliament. So they didn't take any seats in House of Commons. Farage never had a seat in their kind of national parliament, Westminster Parliament. But they were becoming a growing threat in Europe. You then have the GFC. You have on the back of Blairism, then Gordon Brown. Then, of course, you have Cameron in coalition with the Lib Dems in the early 2010s. And then you have all the austerity measures. UK never recovered from the GFC. So things are getting materially worse for the UK. And then, of course, you've got the mass migration thing. And at the time, it wasn't so much Islamic migration, but Eastern European migration. And it was, you know, people turning up into pubs and saying, why are all the beers Polish? Shouldn't we have a little bit more say in who can and can't come into our country? By the time Cameron comes around in, what, mid-2010s, it's a significant enough flank of the Eurosceptics that to put it to bed, and especially because people's material conditions are getting worse, he says, let's go to a referendum and I'm going to stake my premiership on it. He loses the referendum. Farage gets up. That's his big victory. He steps away from UKIP. May replaces Cameron, and then you've got all the wets and the moderates who then try and sabotage Brexit. Farage comes back again with the Brexit Party, threatening a complete wipeout of the Tories because they got first past the post. And so that's then what gives Boris his stonking majority in 2019. Now, what Boris was able to do was he was able to flip all the red wall seats, all of Northern England, this great realignment that Matt Goodwin and others talk about. These are all Labour working class seats. And he also keeps the southeast. Now, the southeast of England are closer to our teal seats. They're wealthy. They're far more socially wet. But because they don't want the turmoil, because Corbyn was the brand of Labour, and he was, you know, this great Marxist, anti-Semite, and everything else. He wins the southeast. He wins the red wall. He has this stonking majority. Then it was, you know, the ineffectiveness of his premiership. Obviously, he's riding COVID, and a lot of people voted for him expecting freedom and the right of the party. Tory premiership is a complete disaster. Richard Tice sets up reform during that period, saying we need a new conservative movement. And then Farage comes in on the back of that. Now, Tories losing in last year, 2024, was not Labour winning. I think Starmer had a lower primary than the previous two Corbyn elections. What happened was that red wall, those Labour working class voters that gave Boris their vote in 2019, they peeled away, and those Lib Dem constituencies and those London constituencies, they drifted further to the left. But if you combine the Tory and Reform vote, Conservatives would have had a clear victory. The challenge for Reform, and I know they've done really, really well recently in local elections, is the southeast. They're disaffected with the Tories, but they're not going to Reform. They're going towards the Lib Dems, and the Lib Dems is becoming the teal trendy party. London is stuck in Labour. You've got Wales and Scotland. They're going to be permanently red or yellow, SNP. They're not going to go for the Tories. So you've got Reformers eating the Tories lunch, but it's still not clear whether or not there's a path to victory. Now, because of first past the post, they don't need 51% of the vote. They need 23% of the vote or 24% of the vote, as long as the vote is fractured. So you could still see a Farage premiership, right? The reason I think this story is really, really important for Australia is we don't have a red wall. Our red wall is North Queensland. and don't get me wrong, like I'm a you know, working class man. There's just not the numbers aren't there. Australia's population, we're 80% on the east coast. Australia's population is like the Lib Dems, and so I think the challenge that we have is culturally these metropolitan seats have drifted so far to the left. I can't see where the numerical pathway is. And if you're looking at out of Melbourne or out of Sydney, these are extremely high migrant areas. And I'm not convinced there's enough WASP votes on an anti-migration platform to flip those red, the equivalent flip.
So we had a referendum, right, where 65, if not more, percent of the population voted against The Voice. And I was saying to a mate, like, I think it's very plausible that those people would also vote in favour of a restrictionist immigration program. That wasn't offered at the last election, right, Jordo?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, I mean, the referendum was a referendum on sort of this third issue, which was, it was this kind of abstract sort of, changing the constitution sort of thing. Whereas something like a reform styled movement in Australia is going to be a referendum on immigration as well, right? And if, yes, these high migrant vote electorates did vote for, vote no, I think, that becomes a very different, it's not going to be a one-to-one transition into voting.
You won't for, be, like, yeah.
Style party. Yeah. Yes, it was like a sort of populist sort of revolt in a sense. You can't really transfer that into voting for, I think I sort of agree with Jared that I can't really see just electorally, like, we're very urbanized, and I was speaking to a couple of friends in England who are sort of close-ish to the reform thing. They sort of said where reform picked up seats was based on proximity to high immigration areas, so not necessarily directly affected by immigration, but close to it. So there was a lot of quote-unquote sort of white flight areas as well, that, people who have left the city, they've gone to Essex, things like that, and all like sort of dying towns. We don't really have that. We don't really have these kind of seats, except for, Queensland, to be honest. I don't really see that many similarities or populist sort of electorates. Yeah, what do you guys think?
Can I just add to that? Quickly, I'm sorry, Dan, just to add to that. The other thing about the difference between the voice versus this, and this is where I think it's more helpful to look at the Senate. So if you look at the way that the LNP, they lost seats in New South Wales, I think possibly Vic, Queensland, it's looking like, and WA, right? So when you look at the state as an aggregate, there are definitely a lot of right-wing votes currently existing that could be harvested that have gone to minor parties, etc. But that doesn't necessarily translate to an electorate. And the best example of that is look at New England, right? So Barnaby gets 60-70% primary, and then the other 30% One Nation voters, say. So you've got 60,000 people right there who are right-wing voters, but they're all in one seat. Whereas then, once you start going to all these urban seats, there it's much more fractured. But it's might be a bit teal, might be a bit wet liberal, might be a bit green, might be a bit conservative. But that there isn't the electoral weight within the actual pathway to form government. And that's where I think the voice is different. And that's where it's like, I think the strategy has to be different because we're not voting state by state, we're voting electorate by electorate, and that's where the demographics of these places really plays out.
Yeah, a mate of mine pointed out that, and you're from the Page Research Institute, which is National Party aligned at least, that the electoral map now almost looks a little bit like the old National Party is the only force in Australia. It has heaps of seats in Queensland and then a smattering of seats in largely regional or rural parts of the rest of Australia. And the Liberal Party doesn't really exist in the capital cities. And to the extent that some people might get up, I mean, there's an outside chance, I think Tim Wilson will, they have not identified them. They've stressed that they're sort of quasi-independent anyway, right? They're not really, haven't associated themselves closely with the Liberal Party. And maybe Tim has a different view, but I think that's a fair enough call. And so that the whole capital cities of the country haven't got a centre-right representation. It's crazy. Yeah. I mean,
pretty much. And even the Nats, right? Like, and this is the, there's a lot of talk about, do we need new parties? Do we need this, that, the other thing?
Mm.
When I look at the National Party team, all the best MPs and senators in the country are in the National Party. Now I might be biased, but I'm dead serious about that. Like as far as they might have all been stuck on the backbench over the last 3 years, but for the National Party's got really good stock. But that's where the National Party should have held the right flank, and if it came out with say a more national conservative platform, I don't think Rennick and Fon would have been as big a force. So I was looking at the Senate, and obviously there's still a few things being finalised. But if you basically in every state, the swing against the Libs was like 8 to 10% or 7 to 10%, depending on state by state. But then if you look at the swing towards One Nation or Rennick or Trumpet, and look at the swing towards Labor, it's split up, and I'd say about 50-60% of those votes have gone towards Labor, and the other 30-40% have gone to those right minor parties. Now, again, if the Nats had have held that right flank, which is, the role that I think that they should play, they could have picked up an extra Senate seat in Vic, New South Wales, Queensland. They almost did in WA, so they're disassociated in WA. I think the Nats nearly outpolled the Libs in WA. There's, if the Nats played their role as anchoring the right properly, it wouldn't have been as much of a bloodbath in the Senate as it was, but because they kind of drifted to the left in the same way that the Libs did, I think that gave a lot of breathing room. And that's not to say that these other minor parties aren't an important role in democracy, but that they didn't end up picking up seats. So they cost the LNP seats without picking up those seats themselves. And I think that's the hurdle that the new party people need to sort of reconcile is, the Nats still have 4,000, 5,000 volunteers. We're going to get out in booths. They're going to hand out how to vote cards. They're going to put out the core flutes. They still have the donor base and the administrative structure in order to operate, professional campaigns. And the miners have an enormous hurdle to get over before they can start to match that. It could just be the right keeps fracturing.
Yeah. Well, John, One Nation have existed for a long period of time. In some ways, they at least recognize the sort of nationalist populist movement in advance of other places, but it hasn't really kind of gone on. I mean, only say how much you want to say, but why hasn't it been possible to go to the next level with One Nation if and then them to become the reform of Australia or the You know,
I think, you know, that they don't have I do think they would benefit from branches at this stage. I also think it's kind of a matter of sort of mass as well. They kind of never really hit that sort of vertical sort of, you know, uplift more than ever, like, you know, a few people at a time. And they've never really sort of made that, you know, people, they've made gains and then people have dropped out and left. And I think you do need that sort of mass movement of people and of figures, you know. I think probably in recent memory, the best, the most optimistic time for FON was when Mark Latham was there. I mean, they then had two really public figures, Pauline and Mark Latham and Malcolm Roberts as well. So there was optimism, and of course it fell out. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to see what it's going to do next. I mean, will it just do the same old thing? I don't know. There's talk about, you know, maybe they pick up another seat in Victoria, New South Wales. It's sort of bouncing backwards and forwards at the moment. But yeah, I think if they ever do want to sort of like replicate the success of reform, they kind of do need to break out of that sort of, you know, 1-2 person place. And to do that, I think it probably requires a internal relook at sort of branches and memberships and stuff like that. Because, you know, they're still hanging on, but, you know.
I find with One Nation, they have the ability to excite but not persuade. So you get great clips on Sky News or God knows what, but you can never make, they're never able to hold an argument with people in the professional classes in the inner cities, which you know, there's a reasonable argument to be made on immigration, trade, foreign policy, and the rest of it, but they're not able to sort of hold their own in those debates. That's why they're dismissed and can't go any further.
Dan, can I say that I think needs to be one of the biggest. Well, that for me is one of the biggest takeaways, one of the biggest learnings. And I think to actually, like if we're serious about transforming our nation, and you talked about, you mentioned before about like, you know, we don't want any more nasty Tories, and that era is over. And I think we're in this fake binary that is absolutely crippling us, where the left or the wets, the moderates, think we need to drift our platform left to win back the centre. And like the centre of normies, they're not engaged in politics to the degree that we are, and they're going to vote vibe and where they feel like is the most moral status, right? There's the wets think, well, we just need to give them what they want. We need to focus test them and say exactly what they want. But then I think where the right can be a bit short-sighted is, no, we need to double down on being argy-bargy and just like yell louder, and it can get a bit Fox Newsy, Sky Newsy, you know, shout at the screen. And actually, I think it's how do you, like, I believe the things I do because I wholeheartedly believe it's the truth, right? Like I'm fundamentally of the belief that net zero will absolutely cripple and deindustrialize our nation, right? So it's not because it's my tribe. That is honestly the truth. Now, why can't I convince people of that? And why can't our movement convince people of that? And why do normies not believe that? And actually, it's because I think we need to think through, and every leader will have their own strategy, but how do we bridge that gap? How do we not be nasty about it? Like you can't tell people that they're, you know, they're idiots.
But
you have to bring them on and give them the make our position the moral high ground. I think that's the work of the right. It's like, I mean, infinity actually, migrants is a terrible idea. Why are people buying into it? We need to give our position as the moral high ground. And this is what Jordo's been doing really good on the housing stuff, is like
actually
explaining to people that there is a rational, elite, high status argument to be made that isn't One Nation, go back where you came from. And I think that's the shift.
Yeah, I mean, I high status Jordo, that's going to be I think even amongst the teal mums, which I'm sure they hate being described as, they are receptive to a restrictionist immigration argument, but they just don't want it to be espoused by a Pauline or whatever, because it's a low. It is for whatever it's worth, they consider that a low status thing, and they don't want to be associated with that, fair or unfair. I just think that's a reality. I mean, how do you make voting teal, Jordo, a low status position?
Mockery. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's the challenge. I think this is the opportunity for the quote unquote online right as well,
yeah.
Which is, there is a lot of creativity on this side now. It's kind of like a band of outsiders of all these hyper intelligent, slightly autistic guys and people who run the world. And I think reform. How much difference it makes is impossible to actually quantify and tell. But I actually think that the influence that does come from online communities and movements now does proliferate down into real politics and real Absolutely. Movement. And you can, if you wanted to, if you had enough concerted people in the room, or even like money behind it, or just like an organic sort of online movement, you could just really knock the heels down a peg and push somebody up a peg. I mean, it's going to be hard with the branding that One Nation has now to sort of set them up as the high status pantsuit nationalism, like you see in like Denmark or Norway or something like that, right? Yeah. But so that's a bit difficult. And I think that's why, people like and really resonate with the policies of One Nation, but the branding does, have an issue, and people have been saying this for ages. And I think that's why people do look for places and people like Rennick and even the libertarians, they're kind of like, well, look, basically identical policies, but, a bit of a cleaner brand from which we can sort of leapfrog all the baggage and push it up there. And I think, the online right can do stuff like that. We either need just millions and millions of dollars or, a vibe shift.
Yeah, I mean, your hero Jordan Bardella. It's got to be the nationalist argument to the professional classes, to the well dressed, people going off to work for PwC or God knows wherever they work. That type of thing. I mean, that's people that Pauline and others can't reach. And
It's a fascinating question. Because usually you're right. One Nation is kind of rooted in the suburbs of Australia, right? But is there a national populism for the cities? Yeah, Bardella, had his opening campaign launch party in a trendy nightclub in Paris, right?
Okay.
Could you see something? Could you outflank the Teals? Could you, a lot of people, the Greens are sort of the inner city left wing party. Is there an inner city right wing party? What's that based on? Is it based on sort of cultural nationalism, economic nationalism? These are sort of the intellectual conversations that should be sort of coming out of the wash
at the moment. What do you think now for the National Party? Because with all the talk about new parties, we have quite a lot of parties in Australia already, and there is a certain advantage that the traditional parties have in being able to man booths, having the sort of DEA of governing the country, the experience in doing that, wiser heads that aren't just, looking for likes on social media. Does the National Party, it still has its issues. I mean, it held seats, but you can sort of see even those seats will be under pressure in due course. Where do they go to? Do they look to expand elsewhere, or, do they antagonize the libs? Do they genuinely think they can sort of do a reverse takeover? All these ideas get bandied around.
Have we lost audio?
I think we've lost him a bit. Yeah, you there, Joe?
I am. I'm bullish on the Nats because you look at their grassroots. Oh, have you still got me? Am I back?
Yeah, got you. Yeah, keep going.
Can you hear me?
I can, mate. Go ahead. Yep.
Whoop. Oh, okay. There might be a bit of a delay or something. Hopefully it picks up.
Keep going.
Okay, I think there's like a massive, like there's like a 45-second delay, so I'm just going to rant, and then if I drop out, sorry. And that's grassroots to awesome. My inbox just gets bombarded with National Party members who a bit frustrated with the current directory of the party. You go to conference, you go to the branches, you meet these people in person, and the heart of the National Party and the heart of regional Australia is still absolutely there. I think the national party's problem in the short term is a strategy problem. And I think the strategy the Nats have adopted is they've thought, well, what's the pathway for the coalition to get to power? We've done a heap of focus testing. We're looking at the map and this is the pathway and the seats that we need to win. And so we need to do this kind of wet drift and be softer on climate change and softer on this and softer on that. I think the first step for the Nats is just like reclaim its base, because each election cycle you do that, good people are going to leave. And it will be very hard to get them back once you reach that point of no return. So the first thing I do is sandbag. The second thing is like we know what the answer is to all the problems that we face, and whether it's debt, whether it's productivity, whether it's energy prices, whether it's migration, whether it's critical supply chains, like everyone knows what the solution to these is. Everyone knows that these are and sometimes existential problems for the country, but there's a feeling that it's not politically popular enough. And that's where you need to, when you actually start selling the message. Like there's a role for pollsters in that, like, okay, how do you feel about climate change, for example? And if the electorate's telling you, oh, I'm really anxious about climate change, I want to have cleaner energy, the response then is not, okay, well, now we're going to lie to the electorate with a policy that won't actually achieve the goal that we're setting out for in order to give the voters what they want. The pollster should then go to, okay, how can we focus test different messaging to try and convince these people a new perspective on the way of looking at these problems? And so I think that's where the Nats need to go. And they need to go persuasion. It's like, we know, like we have all the answers. we know what is required. If we're losing with women and we're losing with young people, why aren't we persuading them and convincing them? Like the debt one for me is like, the fact, Jordo, that our generation isn't absolutely furious at the debt burden that we and our kids will be inheriting. And it's because like that is the intergenerational issue of our time, is the fact that we can't buy a house and we're going to get saddled with $1.5 trillion in debt by the time this government's through. That's existential. That is like our country and our living standards will be absolutely eradicated over the next 15, 20 years of our lives. That should be what young people are marching in the streets about. But no one... Like they don't understand that. Like you talk to people who aren't as politically engaged, like normies, who like they just their politics is whatever the Greens and Abby Chatfield is funneling them on the thing. They're like, well, I want debt forgiveness. It's like, you think your $20,000 hex debt is bad now? Like, just wait to what's coming. And that's the I think it's persuasion. It's like, how are we actually selling what we know to be true, rather than like flip flopping our policy platform based on.
I actually increasingly now instead of trying to sort of persuade people who I've used the term normie con as well. It probably ticks off people, but just get them onto X. I just say, oh, look, are you on Twitter, yeah. X? Just get onto, because as soon as they do, they're exposed to a whole different range of arguments rather than trying to engage in it. But, Jordo, why do you think, I mean, the big surprise of this election was actually the increase in the Labor vote. Why do you think Labor were successful in boosting their primary vote and doing so on this election?
Oh man, I have no idea. I think look, they position themselves as a steady hand. I think Labor are fantastic political operators. I think they've really mastered clientelism as well, especially with migrant communities and things like that. They're, you know, all the public service and various interest groups, you know, really sort of manning the barricades for them. And it's, again, it's basically like every single other election in the Anglosphere now, which is, well, except for America, which is that, you know, it's just their positive response is an indictment on the opposition, and the opposition just didn't, unfortunately, bring the guns. They didn't, you know, they just didn't sell the message. Also, to go back to what Jared was saying about, you know, what we have these existential issues, you know, arguably more pressing, I would say far more pressing than, you know, climate change and things like that, because it's going to have a very real material impact on our living standards and probably, you know, lifespan. Like, people are probably going to get shorter and die earlier, like the massive debt bubble, right? But why aren't we selling it? I think this actually fundamentally comes down to, you know, the psychological differences between the left and right wingers. You know, the left, sort of, when they're sort of threatened, they collectivize, they form groups, they start community, you know, they come together. The right gets blackpilled, like I do, becomes independent individual, moves to Queensland, doesn't do anything, and then like shitposts forever saying it's over. Like, you know, you really, the strategy between the two is obviously like who's going to win there. I mean, it's the people protesting in the streets, setting fire to everything versus the guys fleeing for the country. It's like, okay, well, if that's the inbuilt psychology for the right, which is to sort of be a bit more independent, a bit more individual, is there a way that you sort of weaponize that, you know, for your own benefit? And so, for example, like in America, people sort of talk about how Donald Trump version one was this populist revolution. I think Donald Trump V2 was this kind of revolt of the elites, right? They had Silicon Valley, they had Marc Andreessen, they had a lot of hedge fund capital, stuff like that, switch over to Donald Trump's side. I kind of feel like, you know, that's kind of the actually the natural area of the right. It's like we are so independent, so individualistic. You do have to have this sort of elite shift. And I think probably that, you know, that's maybe a better model for Australia. I don't know, but between, you know, the populist sort of revolt and things like that, because especially Australians, you know, settler colonial nation like ours, very independent minded, spread out. We have a lot of mineral wealth and a lot of, you know, people with mining money and things like that. There is a sort of natural nationalist right wing elite there, but it's just not really translated into what we saw in America.
I think there has to be a change in that in Australia, a convincing of the conservative elite that we have moved on from the John Howard era, great though he was in his time, in different ways, right, and that we are, it has to be a much more national conservative program going forward, rethinking on trade, rethinking on immigration. Because the normie right in Australia thinks, John Howard, if we just replicate that model, that's more or less what we required. And, you know, why is it these people, these electorates don't vote for it? It worked so well back then. You know, what has changed? And if we just replicate it, we'll win back these blue ribbon seats in Ryan and the like. And I was looking at the stats over the weekend, and in the seat of Ryan, which used to be blue ribbon, we have gone back our primary vote 20% in, like we've gone from 54 to 33 in 10 years. That's cataclysmic, a change in sentiment. And, you know, I think, again, housing prices is an underrated explanation for all of this, because you create an elite class, you create wealthy people who have houses, and then they get very excited about post-materialistic concerns like climate change and the rest of it. And then you get younger people who can't afford houses, and they get radical. And they're like, well, which is the most radical party on offer? Greens. Okay, that's the one I'll vote for to flip the monopoly board. And there's no other real legitimate alternative. I mean, yeah, you know, Tucker Carlson, he has that line and says that, look, if a 23-year-old can't legitimately, you know, have a reasonable prospect of owning property and forming a family, then he wants to burn the system down. So you get this, you know, radicalism on the right and radicalism on the left. And I don't think that the Howard era people really appreciate that. They still think, oh, you know, like, yeah, it's always a bit of a struggle, but you can do it. And we had struggles too, don't you know? And like the young people these days, they don't want to, you know, fight for country or, you know, put in the hard work required. And I just don't think they have a proper sense of how the you know, the borders change. What do you think, Jared?
I think a lot of that's true. I think the other thing is actually like there's something that's gone on that has nothing to do with elected politics. And that is that as a nation, as most of the Anglosphere has, the US is clawed back, but we can talk about that. But, you know, if you look at the UK, Canada, us, New Zealand, we've all drifted one or two standard deviations left in just our political beliefs. And I think most people, so there's the burn it all down people who vote for the Greens and get out and protest in the streets. There's the asset class who are looking at post-material things, as you mentioned, like climate change. But then I think there's like a lot of just like working professionals and working mums and dads, or not even mums and dads, and like normies, and they're not politically engaged, but they vote their tribe and they vote the vibe of the time, and every single cultural signal at the moment is left. So all the mainstream media is left. The ABC is left. They listen to Triple J, which is left. They go on their social media, and the only political content that's filtering through to them is either American or it's Friendly Geordies, Abby Chatfield, toilet paper, cheap media. They went through an education system that essentially teaches the Greens curriculum. Even if they're like anti-establishment, it doesn't necessarily mean they're conservative. It just means like, oh, geez, like school was a little bit, a little bit much, wasn't it? And so all of a sudden, if you are the center, or even you consider yourself center right, you're like far left based on where we were in like 1995. Like you look at like Hawke or Keating, like these guys would have been like One Nation voters now. So I think that there's obviously the political project that we need to work on. But there's also the cultural project. That one's like so much harder because that's like all of our responsibility. That's like both independent media, that's like big money. And it's like, yes, a lot of political content, but it's also a lot of not political content. And like the vibe shift in the US is off the back of like, when did Rogan get going? When did Theo Von get going? When did the Daily Wire get going? When did like Tim Pool get going? Like and. And by the time like 2024 comes around, like the right absolutely dominates the online space. It's completely discredited the mainstream media and that cultural cachet. And then of course like all the Disney woke stuff like massively like hit the tipping point as well. And now you've got like some of the biggest shows in the US are like Yellowstone and what was that latest movie, like Warfare. Like there has been a shift towards the right in their cultural outputs as well. Like hip hop dominated the US for like 20 years and everyone's listening to country music. Like Post Malone's making country music now. You know, like he made all of his money making hip hop in the 2010s. And now he's making country music because there's been that shift towards like, it is cool, it is trendy. Now the normies are drifting back towards like more conservative and traditional values. And we don't have normie conservatives or normie traditionalists in pop culture in Australia. The closest I can think of is like Karl Stefanovic. And like, even that in itself is like, like that's bad. Like who's the, maybe like the footy blokes, like maybe like Matty Johns and like you know, the AFL footy show. I'm like trying to think like who are the, and like, yeah, these aren't like politically right guys. I'm just like, who is like not, like who is like not woke and who is like not socially progressive in pop culture in Australia?
We've been ourselves like,
guys left.
The media like, landscape.
They signal kind of blindness, right? And but then they're like, oh yeah, we're the Bush, blah, blah, blah. This is why we support gay marriage, blah, blah, blah. It's like,
yeah.
But the media landscape, though, I mean, it used to be the case that, you know, the set piece 7:30 interview with God knows who Lee Sales in the lead up to the election was really important. The ratings are through the tank. Fewer and fewer people watch that stuff. I know it has an outsized influence because there are clips and it sort of filters through the broadsheets.
Yeah, but
the broad
like online, like Friendly Geordies are still getting 200-300K per video.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Adam Chatfield, you're getting 60,000-70,000 per video, like in three or four things.
Yeah, but Ozpil is getting a million views.
And John Anderson Media. Yeah. Yeah, but great, but like you need a chorus, right?
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be also a sort of, the goal is to fill it out, to have a full symphony of, you know, you can't listen to Ozpil all the time, you know, great as the beats are. You need to sort of have it across the board. So it's sort of reinforcing and relentless and it just swamps.
Can I go back to, you know, I think this again is kind of related to this elite shift sort of thing because, you know, as much as, yeah, there is like a free market with a lot of the media, like Joe Rogan and stuff like that, he's like an entity unto himself. I do think, like, especially in a sort of more managerial, less free market state like Australia, compared with America, I do think a lot of these people literally just straight up are astroturfed, right? Punters Politics, Abby Chatfield, Friendly Geordies. I would not be surprised if there is money coming to them from left-wing organizations, you know, people, you know, aligned with the Australia Institute. And so again, it comes down to and in Great Britain, you know, you have GB News now, which is becoming, you know, a much bigger cultural force, things like that. So for Australia to sort of get that quorum, those speakers and those things, maybe you have to do a little astroturf. if the left is doing it, then why not us? And that again requires an elite shift.
And the elite money in the US is just politically smarter. Like if you know, Peter Thiel sponsored like key kind of cultural elements within the US. Marc Andreessen, I believe, did the same. There was money pushing this stuff, and it helped. I mean, it pushed things which were already existing and successful. But I just think at the moment it is a problem, and it's a job of persuasion to convince people who will fund these things that you can't just rehash the Howard era framework. That's not for the times anymore, unfortunately. It's just not appropriate. The flaws have become apparent. Like open borders, trade, mass immigration. We just need to convince them about our values, and this neocon foreign policy where we get involved in the amount of ink spilt in the Australian on foreign conflicts. Sympathetic as I might be to different causes, that was not the bread and butter concerns of people in the electorate. And the elite in Australia, conservative elite in Australia, are just very much invested in those. They care more about the ethnic composition of Donetsk than they do in Dandenong, is my I think they need to get comfortable with the new politics and realize it's just a much more sophisticated analysis of the times. What do you think, Jared? Do you think we should just tell a different story and get people to believe in Western civilization again, or is that the way forward?
It's probably two thoughts. I'm probably more sympathetic to the ink splash in the Australian on foreign conflicts. And it's not from a neoconservative point of view. It's that we are an exporting nation. We are directly impacted by our commodity prices and then what we can bring back in. And I think one of the things that both sides of politics haven't got yet is the free trade rule, globalized liberal based order that is like completely shattered. And obviously like everyone's pointing at Trump holding the bag on that. But like it just completely denies that Xi Jinping and China for the last 20 years have subverted the WTO at every single opportunity, devalued their own currency in order to maximize their exports, running up huge trade deficits, like intentionally and state-backed actors, seizing all critical supply chains and logistics. So Costco, like an actual arm of the PLA. So not even like the CCP, like the actual military attaché, one of the second or third biggest shipping companies in the world. They're one of the biggest for tonnage coming in and out of Australia. And they have exclusive Steve Dorian contracts on nearly all of our major ports. So the PLA already controls all of our goods coming in and out. So I'm probably more, we do still need to be aware of what's going on because it will materially affect us. And we currently are not set up, be it like through manufacturing, supply chains, critical industries, to go it alone. Like we're just not. So I just park, throw that thought. The other one is there's like the cultural project of like, as Giordo said, like astroturfing, like more conservative voices and like sure. Yes. All for it. Like don't disagree with any of that, but there's also, I hate using this framing because I think like conservatives roll their eyes, but like the problem with women. And it's like at the end of the day, 50% of the population are really struggling to vote for kind of national conservative ideas at the moment across the Anglosphere. Not so much in the US, but it's still a problem in the UK. That blows me away. And that again, that the strategy currently employed by centre-right parties is let's poll women what they want. They then parrot back to them what they've been told by their elite left cultural signaling, what they've read on The Guardian, etc. And it's like reproductive rights and get back into work quicker then center-right parties think, oh, therefore we need to adopt some form of this. Whereas actually I would be wanting to know, like I've never met a mother or grandmother who has not said that having a family and family formation is one of the most fulfilling, meaningful things they've ever done with their lives. And it's the same for dads as well. So don't get me wrong, like men the same, like I'm very pronatalist, like get married, have kids. But like, why aren't women pursuing that path? Why do they think that the most important thing to them is reproductive rights and getting back into the workforce when so many women who've gone a different path are saying the best thing they ever did was raise their kids? And so who are those who've been able to persuade women not to do that? And then the women who have gone down that different path are going, wow, this is amazing. And so I'm like Louise Perry in the UK. I'm looking at Mary Harrington. I'm looking at, we've got Virginia Tapscott here. And like, for the natalist and associative conservative side, it's like, we do have a problem with women. The answer is not to go more left. It's, again, if we believe this to be true, we believe that starting families and having kids is the best thing that we can be doing. Who are the people who are communicating that most?
We don't have an Australian Louise Perry. Well, the ABC nonstop this morning as I was driving around on the radio was talking about the Liberals' women problem. And when you actually get into it, it's, God bless them, but it's a single women problem, not a married women problem. As soon as they get married, they tend to vote center-right. And that's the same. And Trump won the married women's vote. So so it's a delicate subject, but the material conditions make it really hard for people to have the economic stability required to fulfill what, you know, they may pretend they don't like, but they actually often do secretly want to do. But if you can't set up a house in a reasonable neighborhood that's not changing dramatically and getting more and more diverse and reasonable distance from town in a reasonably safe neighborhood, why do you expect people to shun that option of suburban life? Or you can't have you can't survive on a single salary, which is sort of necessary in the childbearing years. Why do you expect people to shun that option? It's not so. Sometimes I think the right think it's just an ideological issue. When Trump's first speech, which is often overlooked, he actually talked about, "Oh, we got to get rich." He was talking about material prosperity amongst other things. It wasn't just these big ideological kind of discussions. It was like, we want to get rich again, you know. And it sounds crude, but material prosperity is it doesn't drive everything, but it is actually important. You don't have a healthy, happy society if this society is not getting richer. Wait, what do you think, Jordan?
That's a fascinating point, because in a way, the genius of the left today in Australia is that it's like a vertically integrated business now, right? It's sort of, it creates its own consumers. And so its poor policies lead to mass immigration, which lead to a housing crisis, which lead to later family formation, less married, less kids. And so they're unhappy. And so then they say, well, we've got this great, benefit. We've got this great party for you that has all the problems. Also, it's all the billionaires' fault that all of those things happened, by the way. And so it's this constantly regenerating. How do you hijack that? How do you break that? If they're creating radicals that are going towards the left and they're going towards the Greens, the right, there was this sort of movement in America where it was, we just have to have more kids and then everything will be okay. But, you can't hijack a cultural conversation like that. You kind of have to deal with the forces that you have now. How do you do that? I really don't know.
You can't wish it into being. I mean, it's just like, you can't just go on you and do it without the material conditions. We talk about the post-material left, the teals and stuff whose houses have gone up. But I think there's a bit of the post-material right. They sit on their patio, their houses have gone up 20%, and they, Western civilization, guys, why don't you believe in it? Well, okay, but I mean, where's my house like you have? How do I realistically achieve that? I mean, your house goes up by magic, where I'm slaving away and commuting and doing all the sort of hard things. And I think in the last election, at least for what it's worth, Labor were a little bit more focused on bread and butter and what I can, if all these promises are going to be on the credit card, then people were like, well, at least make my life a little bit easier for the next 3 years. Where we were much more, we're going to spend all this money on nukes and all this money on defense, important though they are, and all the rest of it. And it was just a little bit like, well, it's a bit pie in the sky, for the here and now. And you can't blame people. I mean, they've got to make ends meet. What do you think, Jared? Jordan, okay.
Can I just jump in really quickly?
Yeah,
just very quickly. Look, I think, to go back to what both of you were saying, I really do think there's a shot here. We do have a shot. You can kind of see, if you kind of put it, the Venn diagram together, there's a little triangle that, national conservatives can really nail. You can really offer a very positive vision. Let's go back to like what Trump was saying. It's like, we can be rich again. We can get the house in the backyard. start the family, and actually all of these things. Like a lot of the millennials that I talk to now, they're kind of burnt out by this kind of like liberalism, consumerist, materialistic sort of Australia. Mm. They're kind of like, well, this is actually horrible. I'm sick of being a leftist. I just want to have kids. So many people have told me, you know, who are prior sort of anti-kid lefties. They're sort of like, actually, I just want a family and stuff like that. And I think that is actually the story. I mean, Ark often talks about telling a different story. I actually think that is the story. The right does actually have this futuristic, forward-thinking, progressive vision that is actually sort of countercultural to what the left is offering. We haven't figured it out yet, but, you know, it is there.
Yeah. What do you think, Drew?
No, I agree with that. I think I mean obviously there's no silver bullet, and obviously like telling people like, look, just ignore that you're poor and everything will be better. Like I don't mean to be like naive or jingoistic, but I'm not you're not saying this, Dan, but I'm not convinced that just telling people it's about getting rich, because I mean it's one of the, not to sound too Marxist on you guys, but like one of the problems of like capitalist consumer society is the market wants all of us to be consumers and producers.
Yeah.
And it actually doesn't want us to form families. And actually it's a completely different like vision of what the state and what the family and what the nation is. And so I probably would be a little bit more interventionist and think about tax breaks and like, how do you ease the financial burdens on family? How do you culturally signal that this is valuable and important, and then look to reinforce that? But then also you need mummy vloggers, and you need like completely non-political entities that make family cool again. And like, I don't think you can astroturf that. I just think it's something that we should be open to and like, not be so dismissive of, because I think that's going to be like really crucial to walking some of this back. To Jordo's point, like there is a triangle there that we can nail. I think people people need to be white pilled and optimistic, or they won't work towards it. And it's not a given that we win. I mean, I look at the UK and the UK was Celtic and Britain. And the Romans came, and the Romans were the elites for a while, and then the French invaded, and then the Danes came, and then became part, you know, Anglo-Saxon, right, Germanic, and they took hold, and the Celts and the Britons, they were pushed out, and then the Normans came, and they became the ruling elite. The Anglo-Saxon nation they're trying to protect now was an invading force that took over and asserted their dominance. And are existential problems and for Western civilization and the things that we care about.
Yeah.
It is that serious. Like, if we lose, that just could be it for this part of the story. And then what continues on this land is not connected to the story that our ancestors were connected to.
I was joking. But also
that's why this is our pushback against, this is our fight, right?
I was joking at one of the after parties on Saturday evening, which is a bit sad, but people were like, throughout history, people have always said, you know, we can either stay here and fight or we can leave. But the correct answer has varied depending on the time. Like, it was correct. The correct answer was to leave East Germany and go to West Hollywood. In other times, it was better to fight. So it's not like, you know, the rallying cry is a genuine question sometimes. And I don't know, you know, sometimes getting the head out of a dodge might be better, but
and on that point, Dan, like our ancestors at the end of the day were people who said that where we were from was pretty shit, and we reckon we could have a better go of it here. And I don't want to be the one that fumbles the bag and then my kids have to go somewhere else. But it's not to dismiss people that do see better options. I also don't see where the better options are, to be honest. Like,
I don't think there are any more options.
Like, it's not obvious to me where we would go.
Yeah, no,
this is it.
We'll see. Yeah, what do you think, Jordo? What are the next 3 years hold? Paint a white pill optimistic picture of where we end up in 3 years' time.
Oh, look, I will say, I mean, in speaking to both of you guys independently and lots of other people prior to the last election, was that there was green shoots sort of forming of a quote unquote new right, national conservatism sort of thing. This really interesting cultural movement that's kind of sprouting. And now, you know, there is a network, right? There is a connected network across Australia of very competent people, very aligned as well, which is very rare, that is forming. And I think, you know, people tried to sort of have an impact on this election, but to be honest, this election was kind of decided, you know, 10 years ago in a certain sense. But now I think, you know, the good thing is that we have a fresh starting point. We have at least 3 years or around 3 years until the next election. We can actually start acting on all of these things that we were talking about, right? We can start building these institutions. If there is to be a new party, we can start talking about that. If there's to be reforming an old party, we can start talking about that. But I think, you know, the optimistic view is that we treat this, hit the big red button, clean slate, start again, and build for the future. We're so back. Actually, I decided it's not over. We're going to win.
what do you think, Jared? Final word from you, and then we'll wrap it up.
I'm pretty black pill about the next 3 years, to be honest. I think regardless of what happens in the new right, I think this is like the splashing ink over what's happening overseas. I think like the next 3 years is going to be absolute bedlam and chaos. Like global recession, more wars. I mean, India's at war with Pakistan right now, and everyone's just like, it's a meme at this point. It's like, pretty serious. They're both nuclear powers. And I'm not trying to be like all hawkish on this. Yeah. It's just being real that it looks far more like the late 1930s than it does the late 1990s. And that's just, you know, so I'm pretty black pill about the next 3 years. I'm like white pill that, like, to Jordan's point, like, networks are forming. You're doing stuff like this. Like we've been in a culture war for 20 years. And like, people have thought it was about like women's change rooms, and like, no, it's about like the heart and soul of our civilization. But we haven't built culture. We've like, the best we've done is get on Sky News and complain. And that is not building culture. And actually doing this, building culture, creating new institutions, new organizations. Yeah. And then like my ultimate white pill is like, even if we lose, I was in South Africa a couple of months back, and like, bordering failed state, things are really, really dire over there. But you go, like, some of these like rural communities, it's like nothing, like they're completely untouched. They're like off the grid. They're all self-sufficient with their diesel generators. And like I walked into like this supermarket in this village that, like, I could have been in Orange. Like it was just like, it was nicer than Orange. It was like the Cotswolds. Like, it was beautiful. And I walk in, they've got like Tim Tams on the shelf, and they're like 6-7 hours drive from the coast at Cape Town. I'm like, where did you get this? Like, somehow these little pockets of oases. So I don't think things will ever get this bad that we can't create a little garden for ourselves. So anyway, that's my ultimate white
pill.
Fight, and then build shies.
I'll conclude by saying this. I definitely think it could get very, very, very bad. I think it's probably the way to bet. But it has given me hope in the last year. I think I only connected with you just over a year ago, right, Jordan? And there's a whole bunch of people that the network has quickly expanded very, very quickly, who are very sharp people, very much aligned on stuff. And there is the kind of beginnings of, or more than the beginnings of, like, the new right in Australia with an Australian accent, which is a good thing, because nothing like this existed 5 years ago. Even the topics, immigration stuff, wasn't a mainstream sort of discussion point. And it just requires the mainstream parties or anyone who wants to get involved, and the elites in Australia, to actually get behind it, understand it, and back it, because that is the way forward. Hey, gents, awesome to catch up. I'll we'll be in touch in future, and it's just the beginning. We'll go from here. Take it easy. See ya.
See you guys.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, John.